this proposal seeks to say that for the 12 months, if you give up your beneficial ownership for only 12 months, then there won't be any capital gains tax or securities transfer tax, and the period is limited to 12 months. And the reason why we limit the period to 12 months is that in terms of common law, when you transfer your beneficial ownership, it's supposed to be CGT, but because we wanted to have market liquidity, so we limited it to 12 months.
That's the one for
this. Yes.
chair at the moment, just to start on that one. To your question, yes, it is like this internationally. If you have a look at, for example, the UK Finance Act every year, they have very substantial documents. You'll find very similar sets of amendments happening on an annual basis around the world. And one of the reasons for that is that tax touches the whole economy. So, yes, we can sit here and we can think we know everything. We can don't. And I don't pretend to. And we do try and anticipate. Now, part of the difficulty, of course, is that we're a relatively small team trying to anticipate what a very large body of taxpayers are going to do. And that then means we are frequently behind the curve. So sometimes we may be a little too inclusive, we can over-inclusive, we can overtax something, we can do something that wasn't intended. And then, as Yanga explained, we then need to relax a little, assist the taxpayers, say, okay, we didn't quite intend to do that, we need to open up a little bit. Other times, we were under-inclusive. Somebody came up with a variation on a theme that we didn't think of, and away we go to the races, they are running ahead, we need to catch up. We'll get to an example of a very complex structure later on in one of my slides. That particular structure is probably the fourth or fifth iteration in a scheme that has been running since around 2000. Every time we change the law, some extra layers of complexity get added to the structure to break what we did and circumvent. And so then we come along and we say, now we need something else to close down that particular variant. We get to the point sometimes where we just have to stop trying to close the variance and then rely on things like simulation. We say, we actually don't believe the structure you've put together anymore. We think, if you look at it in its essence, it's fake. Okay, that is a very tough call to prove in the courts, but sometimes you get to that point. Other times you have to rely on the general anti-avoidance rule where we say, what you've done is so artificial, it maybe it's true and it's not fake, but it is so artificial. Or there are such strange characteristics, and they're defined in the legislation, circular flows of funds, taxing different parties, self-cancelling arrangements, that, in fact, we can apply a general anti-avoidance rule to bring you back within the rules that have been written. So that's two of the drivers here. Now, sometimes there will be a new policy direction. So if you go back to the 2000 I mentioned, that was when we introduced capital gains tax. That is when we switched from the source basis of taxation to residence. Those are massive changes in the system. The carbon tax that is coming is going to be a new policy initiative. But once you're dealing with an existing tax instrument, a very large proportion of what we're doing is tweaking it. And as I say, we're a small team. There's a much bigger body of taxpayers out there. Our imagination doesn't stretch quite as far as it is sometimes. And that's why we're back here every year, enthusiastic about what we've discovered, because very often this is new to us as well. Somebody has done something that we did not anticipate. Sometimes we wish to encourage it, and sometimes we definitely do not. So,
how do you know that the changes you're making are actually proven, that they actually are advances on what you had before? If you keep wriggling almost, right? You keep like maneuvering almost, right? You see, like, if you look at other areas, you can see some sort of linear progress, or you can see retardation, and then you see progress again. Would you, at least me, I find it very hard to know what criteria do I as an MP use? I could use arbitrary or mechanical or artificial things like, look at how much of revenue you are raising as against what you raised last year. But I don't have the ability to tell what the reason for that is. It could be a variety of things, nothing to do with the enthusiasm you bring there on the proposals you bring for our committee. It may have to do with the fact that the economy has grown slightly. It may have to do with the fact that there are other things like your tax collection strategies that improve, putting up kiosks in the malls and so on. So how does an average MP judge whether these changes you are making are overall for the better for the country? Is there a criteria we can use? This is really to ask you. I should really be asking the researchers and PBO and so on. But they can come in when they want to, and then they can call. Remember, this is a different type of thing. I'll be explained. If, I don't know where the lady is rolling in and out. I don't know what she's doing. This is not really, it's a workshop. It's really, effectively, Parliament does allow you to have workshops that are closed, but you don't close them, because then people like you guys will jump up and go to court and all. Oh, nothing really. It's just, it's actually a political education. So we will interrupt it, but in a way we may not, the current changes, if you like. So what I'm saying is, does anybody want to ask? Let's ask you. How, you see, for you, it is very important that we are educated technically. The more we are educated technically, the more effective our engagement with you is, the more your capacity to do the right thing get enhanced. I know some people feel that if you have strong committees, they're a pain, because you'll work for months and months and months on something and we make changes to it without careful consideration. That's how you feel. But the truth is that in this instance, in this case, I think it's important that we understand as much. And Momo, I know your boss, he feels quite strongly about that. Well, Momo is a politician, you know? I can see it through you. How long I know him, right? For those of you who don't know, he was in the underground Communist Party, right? I mean, this guy, if you listen to him now, you cannot believe where he was. Right? He's in the 80s, right? So, I mean, what I'm saying to you is, how do we judge? What criteria do we use? Do you have any views?
I think generally, if you can, for proposals that are working, you can see like on incentives, like your tax incentives that you normally do. You've got slides here whereby you show the UGC, the urban development zone, the industrial policy projects whereby you see the numbers of take up when you give the incentive. And then the numbers of take up, we show that these are the people that are taking up the incentive and DTI, and we've got the numbers like the research and development we did. So on incentives, the numbers of take up you'll see. And then, for instance, on the tax savings accounts that we introduced last year, you can see the banks, the billboards, everyone advertising these are tax savings accounts. Like on the incentives, it's easy to see the numbers of take-ups. And then when you come to closing the polls, like the one that we're going to go to next, whereby there are complicated structures, then there won't be any numbers of take-ups that you'll see, except that you can think that banks will be able to collect more when you close the poll. So it's that's how we see with incentives and tax benefit, like your public benefit organization, the exemptions we give the public benefit organization. It's easy to measure the number of tickets because the more you've got public benefit organization registered in your register, the more you've got incentives.
Let me think about this. What you're basically saying, as I understand you, just see if I'm understanding you. You're saying the way you see whether what you're doing is for the good is through the outcomes. That means you look at each area and you say, we made these changes, I take the tax incentive for you, right, which is on the agenda when the quarterly report comes into it. We can actually see how many people are taking it up, right? And whether you're using the allocation fully or 70% or whatever, right? But that's after the fact. You come to Parliament before that. The question members of the committee might want to apply their mind to, and PBO might want to say something about to some stage, is how do we as a committee, when they come with these proposals, how do we as a committee decide that this is actually, on the whole, fair and it's effective, the proposal is going to happen, it's going to be implemented, and it's going to increase our revenue in a way that encourages growth and development in our country? Sorry? I can't hear you. Sorry?
Two things that are functioning.
What's
the function? It's the way.
But as a committee, we have to have criteria to look at these things. That's my point. I'm just saying we need to mull over what would be the criteria. Have you got any Sean, you want to say something?
Thanks, Jefferson. This is obviously a very important question for us as the Parliamentary Budget Office, because of the kind of thing we're supposed to assist committees with. I think as our colleagues from National Treasury and South indicated, it's going to vary depending on the nature of the proposal. So some, you know, if you've got an incentive, it has a particular policy objective, and you can measure that by using certain proxies in terms of take-up rates. That's kind of the first step, because obviously if you don't have take-up of an incentive, then clearly not having an effect. A second step in the process would be to say whether you're actually getting value for money in that incentive. So the committee had a presentation, I think, either earlier this year or last year by the Jobs Fund, and there was a discussion about cost per job. So that's the second stage of thinking about it. as we raised yesterday, is the issue of revenue collection, particularly when it comes to closing loopholes. But the other thing which we haven't mentioned yet, of course, is that in some cases about applications of certain principles, a particular type of provision in the legislation might be considered to be incompatible with the principles that are supposed to inform the legislation. In some cases, of course, implementing those might lead to a decrease in revenue collection. In certain cases, if you're eliminating double taxation, you might actually find that there is lower revenue collection from certain types of taxpayers. So it will vary depending on the nature of the provision. I think if you ask academic economists, they would favor an impact-oriented evaluation. But I think it's also important to say that from an academic point of view, that's fine. But in a policy context, that's not realistic. So I think where it's possible to do that, to actually get numbers from national trading class to indicate the impact on the objectives that were that are used to motivate the provisions, then that's great. In other cases, the committee may satisfy the rationale for the changes are appropriate. With the rate rules, for example, what is the rationale for raising particular rates and not others? You know, why raise personal income tax rates and not corporate income tax rates? There must be a rationale behind that. So it'll depend on the incentives, but I think there are options available to the committee to improve engagement, if that's helpful.
I'm handing over to David now, but just to try this up rather than hanging in the air, I don't know what the answer is. I don't think we've gone sufficiently on this thing. Something we need to think about over time.
So. Thank you, James. Apologies for being slightly late. I think you have a very important point, and I think what always guides us when we try to formulate policy is the various principles that guide this policy. We're talking about the issue of neutrality, fairness, revenue buoyancy, and stability. There's basically tenets of taxation that guides us, and those are important principles. One can test your tax proposals or tax system against those principles. And obviously, at times, there are trade-offs. You can't achieve all of them. And the question is, what is the optimal trade-off? I think that's the overarching principle that you should be doing. Then the second layer of testing is the question of whether you can quantify the revenue impact of a particular proposal. And from cases like increasing the corporate rate or the personal income tax rate, it's pretty easy. In others, where you play around with the base and adjusting the base, it becomes more difficult, but probably not impossible. The third layer is the question of administration. Then there's a question of court cases that started to feature loopholes that they've encountered. I think you can cascade it down to that particular, broadly, I would say, three categories. You probably can think of more. I mean, that's maybe some of the guidelines that we can suggest to you, sir.
Jay, thank you very much. Just to say in response to your comments, my max grade is slightly higher, but I think my current tax knowledge is pretty much on par or possibly lower than yours. But I'm delighted to say that the same does not apply to my colleagues. Jay, I wonder if before we jump into the detail, I could ask a very general and first order question given the fact that this is a workshop. My understanding is that when the minister presents his budget, which he did on the 21st of February, the 25th of February, he made proposals for certain additional or new tax proposals, levies, and duties. And following that, it is SARS's responsibility to collect that tax and those duties and levies. My question is, what authority in law does SARS have to collect those new taxes, levies, and duties?
Well, it depends on the tax. So, for example, with the introduction of the new tax scale for individuals, if you go to the fourth schedule, you'll see that there's a provision that permits the commissioner to issue a tax table,
paragraph 9,
which is based on the rates and changes foreshadowed by the minister. So essentially that's what SARS does. We issue, and if you go to our website you'll find it, we issue a set of tables which are based on the revenue proposals. obviously it isn't Parliament's right to change those review proposals. And then what would happen is, on assessment, we would refund you or charge you more. That would be balancing. Paragraph 9 of the full schedule. No. We have specific provisions in legislation, and that's why it depends on the tax. So we have specific provisions in the legislation that permit SARS to collect revenue on the basis of an announcement. So the legislative authority lives in the Income Tax Act, fourth schedule, paragraph 9. If you go to transfer duty, there's a similar provision that says, again, that's worded slightly differently, because these come from different eras, which that particular provision says that the minister's announcement has effect from announcement for a period of up to 12 months until such time as Parliament takes a decision on the proposal. If you go into the customs and excise space, there's again a provision which says that the moment the minister tables, and that's why it's quite important we get a little note from Parliament saying this is the time that the minister tabled the proposals, the new excise duties take effect. So there are various legislative provisions that kick in. Now, it may be there are some provisions where that does not occur. And so I think historically, we did not always have the provision for the transfer duty. Then it was, of course, up to the taxpayer to decide whether to pay or not. Of course, the problem was if Parliament then agreed that the rate had changed from the date the minister specified, SARS would come along later and collect from you with interest. So those are the kinds of framework that we were dealing with. But So, to take a topical example, if the back rate were to be changed, or the minister would announce a change in the back rate, at present there is no provision in that act that says from the date of the minister's announcement the rate will change. Of course, in the VAT context, that would be very important because it's a transactional tax. If we're dealing with something like an income tax, which is periodic, it's less important because you have time periods to adjust. So, again, no one size fits all here, I'm afraid.
Chair, I think the fourth point there is that, as far as it can be, obviously the legislature then authorized the proposal, and that if it's approved in terms of law, it's kicking from the date of that particular provision that comes in. And then the money would be collected historically based on that impact on the system. If it doesn't, obviously, then there's a refund system that has to kick in. The difficulty that we face is that your budget announcement, your budget planning, starts from a particular date. And legislation follows, and I think there is a provision for the legislature to approve the thing. Up to now, for example, the PIT system, we have announced reductions and changes to the PS schedule for many, many years, and it kicks in immediately. If that didn't happen, it would have been resulted into huge refunds at the start of that period. This is the first time we've increased the rate, and obviously the story is different.
Thanks, sir. Sorry, I just thought it might be useful for the committee to locate this question in the context of the Moneyballs Amendments and the Moneyballs Act. The Moneyballs Act requires the committee to produce a report on the fiscal framework and revenue proposals that are tabled with the budget, and then later on the committee is asked to deal with the rate law and the taxation law amendment bill that contains some of the proposals. And so one of the issues that has arisen for the committee and also for the PDO is if the committee does accept the revenue proposals, does accept the fiscal framework, and then 6 months later considers the rates bill itself, what does the committee do differently when it comes to the rates bill if it's already produced a report accepting the proposals? So there has been a little bit of a disconnect there. But this year that's been, I think, to some extent stressed because the draft rates bill was actually provided. But it comes up in the context of the procedure envisaged in the Act, and it's also useful to bear that in mind, I think.
indicated before, it's a variation of a team to close a loophole of something that we have done, which taxpayers are using it in another way. What happens is that currently, when you determine your taxable, when you determine your tax liability, the tax liability is on the taxable income of that taxpayer. And taxable income is the amount remaining after deducting all the allowable allowances and deductions, and the deductions follow the Section 11A general deduction formula. And in order for you to deduct, the expenses must be expended for the to produce taxable income of the taxpayer. So only business expenses that are deductible. Therefore, one can say that interest incurred on debt used to fund a share purchase is not deductible because a share produces dividend income, and dividend income is exempt from normal tax because it's subject to dividend withholding tax. However, on the other hand, interest incurred on a debt used to fund the purchase of business assets as a main concern is deductible because business assets produce taxable income. Go to the next slide. So what happens is that because interest incurred on a debt used to finance shares is not deductible, taxpayers entered into complicated structures only so that they can deduct that interest. For instance, instead of step one, if you want to acquire a target company and then incur a debt, and then that debt then got interest. However, because interest is not deductible if you acquire shares, so they go to step two and form a new co. So new co will be like an operating company acquiring the target company. And then go to step three, whereby all the debt used, the new co raises interest-bearing debt to acquire the target company, and that interest will be deductible. So they enter into these step three structures, and then they use something like debt push-down structures. So what happens is that in 2012, because they say, no, taxpayers are entering into all these complicated structures because they want to deduct only this interest. So in 2012, we made changes and we gave a special interest deduction, which is outside the general tax principles, to say that if you incur debt to acquire shares in an operating company, that company must be operating as a business, even though you're buying shares, then you deduct that interest. So we did that in 2012. So taxpayers used that for something else. So they came with a new structure because they did not want to purchase shares on the operating company. So they enter into the unintended structure. That is, they have an acquiring company, a holding company, and an operating company. And you find that they purchase shares, the operating company is 10% and the non-operating company is 70%. And this was not intended because if you purchase shares in a non-operating company, it's not a company as a going concern. So now the 2015 changes that we are doing here are closing down this structure so that they only are allowed to do the structure shown in example 2. As Francis said, we'll relax the tax principle so as to give taxpayers some relief, but taxpayers will use this for unintended consequences, and now we have to come back to Parliament 2 years down the line to say that no, the thing that we intended to use is used for something else, so we want to close down that thing. So this is what the debt financing acquisition Section 24 all changes are for.
Loopholes are regarded negatively by revenue collectors because it generally reduces the revenue collection, and quite the opposite by taxpayers. Now, in this particular example, have you a live example for us? And how many have you experienced since we amended the law that allowed this loophole?
Yes, the answer is we do have live examples of this. I unfortunately don't have the numbers with me, but this is one of the structures which is easily turned to many purposes. So if you leave it unchecked, it's one of those that will continue to grow. It doesn't have a naturally limited space. I would point something out. even on this particular blessed structure, which we've omit, the company now is able to get tax-deductible debt at two levels, whereas previously it was only one. So this is quite a significant concession. Once you permit this, you can stack the number of layers at which debt can be introduced with multiple, because remember, what we're looking for is holding company, operating company, so two levels. As soon as you allow non-operating company, I can have holding, acquiring company, non-operating company, non-operating company, operating company. So I can now start stacking the levels of debt. I can move the debt around in the group. And as you can see, I'm getting into forgetting minority shareholders, whereas what we were intending there is you're taking over a real business. So, as I say, your problem here is that this is a fairly generic concept that can be used in multiple ways, and that's probably one of the more dangerous ones. Sometimes you'll come across a loophole which, while we obviously like to close, has a naturally limited scope. Some of them are very open-ended. Just another point that I'd make, if you go back here, you'll notice in step three, one of the procedures that was used to make that work was our tax-free group rationalization rules, which again were intended to assist taxpayers to move a business to wherever it was more economically efficient to do so in a group. We said it back in 2001 and then again in 2002 when they were rewritten, that we expected those rules to come under immense pressure. Because as soon as you allow tax-free movements of assets, there's clearly a very good policy case for that to happen. But the fact that you can move an asset tax-free just gives immense scope to tax planning. And so that set of rules is always under pressure. We come back here regularly to tweak them. So people find some innovative way of moving an asset in such a way as to create a deduction where we never intended one to exist. So long answer to a short question, I'm afraid.
The next one is not too much of a policy issue, but there were lots of questions that were raised on removing anomalies arising from cancellation of contracts last time. Like taxpayers often enter into contracts including but not related to the purchase and sale of an asset. So when such contract is cancelled, because you can cancel a contract at any time after you've entered it, the cancellation of a contract is regarded as capital, is regarded as disposal and attracts capital gains tax purposes. So as we have said last time, the cancellation of contract must have between connected persons, and then now a bit who are connected persons, individual, the relative, is a trap, is a benefit. It's a tax concept. It which is defined in section 1, hence I've got... Hence I've got a description of a connected person in brackets that is member of a partnership or a group of companies. So it's not in a layman's sense connected person. That's even worse. Okay. So what happens is that between connected persons, it gives rise to certain anomalies. So this provision is causing anomalies because there are unintended consequences because parties will enter into a contract, cancel it within a 10-year or the following year, and then they get a surplus in the base cost of an asset or a capital loss. For instance, the current adjustment rules that are in the Act now before the changes are brought, in that when the contract is cancelled, the original owner will get a step up in the base cost, and then if your base cost is high, you pay liquidity. So now, the 2015 changes are meant to close that loophole, more especially between related or connected persons, because you can only do that if you know each other. So the following 2015 changes are saying that if you entered in the same year and you cancel the contract in the same year, enter your contract in January and cancel in March within the year of arrestment, because it's not the calendar year, it's the year of arrestment, then nothing. There won't be any capital gains tax trigger. So there won't be any adjustment, nothing. It will be deemed as if you've never entered into a contract. If you entered it in the same year of assessment and cancelled it in the same year of assessment. However, if you enter into contract in year one and you cancel it in the following year of assessment, then what happens is that the adjustment will be like the base cost of the asset at the time of the cancellation, like when you cancel the contract, will be limited to the base cost of an asset at the time you enter the contract. So there won't be any adjustment in the base cost because we want to close that loophole so that you don't get a step up in the base cost of an asset. Also, the capital gain loss will be included in the current year of cancellation, which is equal to the capital gain which was there at the year of entering into a contract. So we are saying that if you cancel in year one, if you enter the contract in year one and cancel in year two, it is like you are in the same position at the time you entered into your contract. That's what we are closing. And here we are closing the annually because we thought the legislation is working, but the system has no especially connected person. We're using it for unintended consequences. I can agree to that.
Or difficulties, you're crossing a year of assessment boundary, and that is always the problem you have with a year of assessment. So what we end up doing here is we try our best then, because you have a countervailing. So let's assume you had, in terms of that contract, capital loss in the first year, and then somehow you managed to wiggle out of the contract and cancel it because you discovered it was a really bad deal, so you get out of it. Correct. Well, connected in this particular case. Then what we say is, fine, so you had the loss in year one, we will give you a capital gain in year two to offset the loss, and we'll put that value of the asset back where it was. So that's the best we can do within the confines of a year of assessment model.
The next one is addressing the issue of return of capital after HFCA has held a share for 3 years. Generally, when you sell shares, you trigger either capital gains tax or normal tax, depending on the circumstances of a taxpayer. If the taxpayer held a share, the capital asset is capital gains tax. If the taxpayer is saving, then it's normal tax. However, in 2007, Section 9C was introduced in the Act to give certainty to taxpayers so that at least in the criteria that SARS will look at, and even taxpayers, to say that if you've held a share for 3 years, it will trigger capital gain tax, not normal tax. And capital gain tax is attractive to taxpayers because of the lower effective tax rate of the capital gains tax regime offers. For instance, the effective tax rate for CGT on companies is 18.6%, and for individuals is 13.65%, compared to full normal tax for companies, which is 28%, and individuals 41%. So this was a welcome decision. This was a welcome proposal. However, there were anomalies in Section 90 that after 3 years, you may not return cash. There can be something else other than cash that you get on check, because the players will enter into transactions and then don't get cash. And also, what was the meaning of the term disposal for this session? So now, the 2015 changes, they clarify the policy intent to say that after 3 years, whatever you are returning, whether it's cash or anything, it will be treated as capital because you've held the share for 3 years. And any expenditure on that share, what that you held for as for 3 years, which is treated as capital, the expenditure will be of a capital nature and will be ring-fenced against the capital income. So means that the expenditure will not be deducted against the other normal income. And then the term disposal for 9C is the term disposal for capital gains tax purposes. So that's what we are aligning. We are clarifying the anomalies. This was a welcome proposal in 2007 because it gave certainty to taxpayers and it gave taxpayers a relief because if you held the share for 3 years, it takes the CGT rate, not a normal tax rate. So I will end there. And then maybe we will continue with the PIT and retirement reform.
This is a cluster of the tax structure.
Okay.
Okay, over to Lilith. Comments, contributions, questions? This one seems quite clear to me. Yeah, of the ones that I was able to follow, this one's the easiest. Just started with this one, you know, and immediately we filled us up. Okay, over to you. You've got 1 hour, whatever you want to say. The opposition member, you give them space and time to contribute and comment, and they don't want to do it. Then they go to the office and say, the chairperson rephrase the stand. I give you all our help to comment.
You have one.
Okay. Right. I want to tell you something, guys. When we're in public enterprises, the DA for once had a very good member. This guy was really, really good. I don't know why you got rid of him, right? So then what he did was, Sandy, you're not going to believe this. We asked him because he knows so much about hedging, right? I forgot his name, how you might say. He knows so much about hedging, right? He's an expert. I mean, we are politicians, but this guy is a technical expert. So we actually invited him to do a workshop, right? So one or two ANC members got ruffled. They said, hey, comrade, great. How can you invite the enemy, the DA, today? We don't have a research team. And notice we have no content advisors, Sandy. We don't have support services, right? Hey, you know what? None of us understand these issues. It's not a political thing. But the guy came. And after the study, after the thing, I asked the study group members the following. Now tell me, how many of you here saw any ideology in what he said of the DA sort? You know? The backwards, feudal, free market, pernicious capitalist policies of the DA. Where did you see that? They all said, great. What is this guy? Can we have another? Can we have another input? He was really, really good, right? But also, I think I'm edging towards saying, if you understand these issues as much as you involved here, there, David Mayer says you do, well, I'm quite happy for you to give us a little edge. I'm serious, actually. You know what? This is a workshop situation. So, if people have expertise, like, I'm very happy to talk to you about the existence of the proletariat and its value to the growth of the economy and jobs. And your role is under the division of the proletariat. I'm happy to give you an input on that. I do that very easily. Right? But now, on XL, I gather from your involved there that you are like an expert. So I just want to say there has been a precedent, Andy, before people chop my head off. We've done it. But on a more serious note, I want to say, today is a very good day for me. You see, I just got an email. And I want to be open and transparent, unlike other MPs. 1.5 million. Let's show you. I'll show you. 1.5 million has been. UK pounds. And then, you know what I believe this, right? While I'm with you, then came an SMS to Rika. Rika, I'm getting 550,000 rands if I found this number. So can I please ask you, can I please ask you, what is the tax implication of me getting 1.5 million UK pounds and 550,000 rands? We don't take more than I'll get from these two. They didn't like me, obviously. I've got two in the space of, I'm not exactly, two I showed it to him, two in the space of about 10 minutes. You know the thing that befuddles me is how you will get a lawyer or even a professor actually falling for this. You know, you read in the newspaper. I mean, really, it astonishes me. You know, I can understand a poor person, you know, who's got illusions like Gandhi and so on, and he's grasping at, you know, every straw. But you see the people in the newspaper that are taking it. What would happen if I found this number, by the way? Ask me to phone a number.
What is that?
They'll ask you the SIM card. Because, you know, I can see how they would access my email, right? I mean, my bank page, because that's an email. But this is actually, I asked me to phone a number. And it's coming from a cell number. Great news. You have been rewarded with 550,000 rands in 2015 RICA registration with reference RICA 409SA. For more information, call. Thank you. David, because I like you so much, I think I'll bequeath this money to you. As long as you never say another word in this committee. After that, yeah. All right, we'll just ask that offline this week. Okay, over to you, Mr. Sissel. Yeah. Oh. Oh,
Oh, I see, yeah. Okay, that's another thing, eh? Okay, go for it. No, no, he's saying that, you see, interestingly, it's got an 072 number. He says your phone is number handy. You're paying sometimes an extremely high phone call bill. So somebody's paying you. I mean, who would phone back in? I mean, it's astonishing. It shows the desperation of people. All right. Okay, go for it, Sissel. Yeah, I spoke with Momo. I think I understand. What does annual tradition mean?
Annual tradition basically means that when you retire and you've got savings of, say, 2 million rand,
Subject to tax, but on a special table, and with it's a more generous table in some respect, gives you quite a significant amount tax free, and then there's a reduced rate that steps up, and then you finally get to a maximum of 36% tax.
For equity reasons, we say, look, you need to have, because you can't allow contribution is now very simple. An employee has any contribution to the job in local taxes. But in your hands is the tax of the income. You may contribute, you may contribute up to 7.5% of the income or the operation, up to that. Since the common system benefits a lot of people, you apply the next This shows you three examples of the first things of the broader network to scale global institutions. And we think to run this number, the action will be better than the
pension fund only deals with pensions, right? So, you know, it is amazing, actually, how fairly literate people, right, misunderstood. But you also have in the past say this thing, that it's not that they're not literate, it's that people are hugely indebted.
That's the point.
And I think that's the impetus, you know. It's easy for us to sit here and be rational about it. I mean, if you look at some of the studies on Maracana and the amount of money people owe, you know, to their own shops. I mean, it's really quite astonishing. So, this thing, is something that's been preoccupying this committee for quite a while. We don't really know fully, you know, but when we meet next week, maybe we need you to give us a quick account of. We met the government employees pension fund. The new CEO came as a country visitor there the night we met them. So we have put them on the agenda for this year. In the last quarter, we will have a look at the annual report. Okay, which members? This is a big thing. As you know, we're looking at it constantly. I don't know what the ANC's agency document said, but there's something in the newspapers yesterday about finance reform, I think, and what the majority party wants to do. This is linked, obviously, to the whole issue of levels of saving, how challenged we are, especially in the current global conjuncture. So we will look at this exhaustively next week. But in the meanwhile, there may be comments that people want to offer, questions they want to ask. Anybody? No? It's getting much faster than I imagined.
Is that in place of that previously, if you emigrate,
longer.
Christian, how do you set what a reasonable age?
You know, you said that a reasonable amount, sorry, that a person can contribute without.
Thank you.
regard to financial institutions, let's go to the next slide. If you get this team of these amendments, this amendment came from the minister, like from the financial sector policy, that is regarding the hedge fund. Currently, hedge funds are investment vehicles used by both individuals and institutions. And at this, before 1 April 2015, these hedge funds were not regulated by the FSB, Financial Services Board. So in the budget speech, the minister said from 1 April 2015, the hedge funds will be regulated. So regulation of the hedge funds brought about certain things, like the advantages was that if the hedge funds are regulated, there is protection of investors because FSB has got an oversight of the hedge funds. And secondly, to provide tax certainty because you know that now the hedge funds are regarded as collective investment schemes, so that they be treated as collective investment schemes because now they're like fighting the tax system to know how to check these hedge funds depending on the type of investment. So now, when the minister made the announcement from April to say that the hedge funds will be regulated, the industry came to us to say that now we are moving us from one vehicle, which is the hedge fund, to another vehicle, which is the CIF, collective investment scheme. And when FSB has to regulate the collective investment scheme, there are certain assets that are approved by the FSB to be formed part of the collective investment scheme. Some of the assets won't be approved. So when we transfer from hedge funds to collect investment schemes, there will be tax consequences because we are changing from one institution to another institution. So current proposal is saying that if you change like before, the before one is currently an investor will invest into a company and the company invests into a trust and the trust will buy the assets. So now when they are regulated, it takes out the layer of the company. So it will be investors directly into a trust, which is a collective investment scheme, which is regulated by the by FSB, and the trust, the CIS, will invest directly into the assets. So regulation of hedge funds take away the layer of the company. So when you do that, we want to say that the current 2015 proposal saying that the proposed structure moving from unregulated to regulated, no test should be triggered as a result of the regulation because we want people to be regulated so that they can provide certainty and protection of investors. So these 2015 changes are just transitional based on regulation. So when the hedge funds have already changed, you will see that these tax proposals will no longer be used because they'll all be moving to from hedge funds to CIS, so the regulation will be done. The next one? Collective investment scheme. A unit trust. I think this one, it gives relief. It gives relief to taxpayers because we want liquidity in the market. Because you see that most countries, they've got Islamic finance rules, which is equivalent to traditional finance and getting interest offered by banks. So we started introducing Islamic finance rules in our income tax system in 2010. And in 2011, we made further amendments so as to make this Islamic finance regime more relaxed so that they can be more taken up by taxpayers. So the current provision, the 2015 changes, we are extending the current, the existing Islamic finance to listed entities because the Murab, Merub, Baha and Sukuk were only provided to governments and public entities. So now we are extending to listed entities so that there can be more liquidity in the market. And you'll find that maybe next year we come with another proposal because we want more market liquidity and it depends on what other countries are doing.
Members, can you explain these two terms, Murabaha and Sukuk? What are they? I know I went to Madrid and all that, but hey, that was like 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, you have to
So in Islam, the paying of interest is not permitted. So you are in the position which Christianity was in the sort of Middle Ages. There was a similar prohibition. Now, what then happened was, for good or for ill, one particular religion, being Christianity, relaxed those prohibitions. You can argue theologically whether that was good or bad. My expression over you on that. Islam maintained those prohibitions. So what you have is a series of constructs which give you a similar outcome, but without the payment of interest. So you will have, and forgive me, I'm not sure which is which here, but you'll have a system where you can enter into essentially a partnership, and you have a limited profit share, which then fulfills the role of the repayment of what in loan finance would be considered the capital and the interest. You can have participations in the purchase of assets. And so there are a number of constructs which Islam recognizes as being theologically acceptable, which would give a financier a similar outcome as what we would be considered a loan with the charging of interest. But the technicalities are such that they are not a loan and interest. So what the tax system attempts to do... Sorry? So essentially then you have these constructs which the tax system recognizes and tries to put into the similar framework so that it works as part of our tax system. Aware of several non-Islamic banks and Islamic banks that would offer this kind of finance. So, you know, if you walk into your local branch.
I don't mind what I did. I was just thinking of.
Not a problem. Just because I decided to take members seriously. If you walk into your bank next time, have a look at the wall. Sometimes you'll see their certificates, you know, we're registered financial services provider, etc. and so forth. Quite frequently you'll see yet another certificate saying we are authorized to offer particular kinds of Islamic finance by the theological authority.
Wow. Of taxpayers actually deposited in the country. How many of them are there in this country?
Okay. I don't have those details at my fingertips. I'm not sure if any of my treasury colleagues do.
We don't have, but what we've discovered is that other banks, other big four banks, even if it's not Islamic banks, do offer these types of financial arrangements. So that's all we have, that it's not offered only by, it's offered by all banks, by all financial institutions.
It's not typical, but yeah, normally we are big. The purpose is to kind of bring them into the tax net. How does one then determine the taxable income in that kind of arrangement?
Essentially, it's two things. It's to allow deduction on the side of the person, on one side of the transaction, and to tax. Essentially, what the tax system does, it works out what the interest analog would be. So it takes the model, it converts it to interest analog, and then taxes that. Being very careful not to call it interest along the way.
See, what's the theological underpinning for why? But it's not relevant to this meeting.
Okay, over there to the next issue.
There's a few circumstances. Years,
two ways. One, you own the machinery and you use it for yourself. The other mechanism that you can also provide for is you lease out a particular machine to another person, then you then you then get rental income. What has happened in some sectors, especially the automobile sector, that the business model has changed. They've got a different business model. And some of the original equipment manufacturers buy the equipment and make the equipment available to other companies to do parts for it. So they own the equipment, like a specific design or whatever. They purchase a particular model, make it, produce, and provide to a completion process. That company will use that equipment to make that parts for the company. And if the original equipment manufacturer wants to change the shape of the stuff, they will change the size of the equipment and that. Currently, none of the two parties can take the creation because the equipment belongs to the one person who doesn't use it for production, and the other one that doesn't use it for production doesn't own it. And so we're making a change here to allow the original equipment manufacturer, the owner of the capital, to claim a deduction. And the next slide illustrates to you that the two examples of tax compensation. On the one side, neither the manufacturer nor the component supplier can claim a depreciation. Some people that claim it, they technically breach the law. Yeah, but the law doesn't provide for it. And actually, charge it, order to them and charge it, take an action against them because they breach the law. So we need to fix it because we don't want gain the very specific principle. There it is. I think probably unintentionally. I don't know, Franz, you want to come here? It seems it's not the only sector that uses model, but obviously we open it up. But there needs to be a very clear contractual arrangement between the parties in order for this to apply, so that you can get, again, views of the system. Like many banks have in the past done sort of, was it buyback lease agreements? Yeah. Maybe we can talk about it.
I mean, you're referring to sell and lease back agreements. So that was pre-CGT, which in and of itself would make it less attractive. But what banks were doing was, let's assume I've got an old asset in my hands which has depreciated down from its original cost of 10 million to nothing, and I need a loan of whatever many millions. I then sell the asset to the bank for its current market value, which let's say Rand has appreciated and so on, and it's now worth 50 million. I would not have been taxed on, I had a recoupment up to 10, not have been taxed up to a value of 50 million, and the bank would then have claimed a full wear and tear allowance on the 50 million. So we created an asymmetry in the system, and so obviously the banks got into that business. We challenged it, we didn't do so well in the courts, so the legislation was changed to limit the amount that you could write off in a sort of situation so that, again, you restore symmetry. Then when we introduced capital gains, we realized, okay, that was less of an issue, so that we changed the rules slightly to account for a possible gross-up because it was taxing the capital gains system. So, more detail than you probably want, but just to show that we are responsive to the issues, and when the environment changes, we do try and change. We don't leave it as it sort of was. We try and update to take account of the fact that perhaps it's not quite so attractive to do what you used to do, so we can relax the rules somewhat.
So we just didn't open a loophole that you have to come back and close again.
No, I was saying the latter response covers me, because my worry is that if we change Chelsea, is there no other unintended consequence? You know what was running in my mind? I was thinking like, okay, fine, here's a depreciated asset, and then the bank is written it off, and then there's some form of collusion between the owner and asset with the bank to add two more assets to get to the rate of 50 million rent, just to go around to get that benefit again, you know? Because who decides that this asset has depreciated? Who writes it off? Do we have that capacity in the department to make that determination? Or do we leave it to the hands of the banks and other institutions to determine if an asset is depreciated? And in actual fact, it can be utilized elsewhere, like renting it out for further work and, gaining more capital on it, you know. Because, the limitations of legislating activities of individuals is that it's very fluid. They've got a way of moving around, you know, and finding creative way of circumventing what you put in place. And, you know, when you try to close this gap, they find another creative way of doing it. So if we have that capacity, and I'll make an example why I'm saying that. In the price market, you find that, let me give an example with property valuation, right? The current GST that we see that with is, when we evaluate land, there's land valuators outside that tends to evaluate land at a higher as compared to government evaluators who say, no, this bit of land is only valued at so much. And they find a way of putting it high up there, and we end up paying more for actually what people got loans to buy that land from development banks that are government owned entities. So we still have that challenge as we speak. So who decides that? Who decides whether the petrol price should go down? Is it people who are in the Department of Energy, or is it some analysts out there in the market who do it? And, you know, so that I don't want to give us a case by case example of what you experience, but it's generic to have that understanding that the new development that we're inserting doesn't have an unintended consequence for energy.
You want to respond to that?
I think Linda's quite correct. I mean, this is an area. So the risk is less in the write-off per se, because the write-off is either set by the legislation 14/2020, or by way of interpretation that SARD has issued, where we give guidance as to what we would consider acceptable write-off periods to bring an asset from its original value down to when it's worthless. So, but correctly put, it's value that is usually the issue. That is the hard one. Back in my career, when I was at the coal face, I remember back then it was intellectual property that was the hot topic, and you could ask three different valuers, and you probably get six opinions as to what the value of the intellectual property was. And sometimes the differences were huge. So that is why systemically you often have to make changes to counteract that kind of problem. So, for example, we were talking sale and lease backs. So in a situation where you had a sale and lease back, the response we had there was to limit the deduction to interest. So to take away the incentive of having a very large deduction on this now appreciated asset. In a connected person, I've described we limited the value of what you could depreciate based on what the original cost was. so that you couldn't game the system there. And so you have a number of responses. In this particular one, I can think of a couple of things that people could do, and obviously we'll try and anticipate what they could do. And interestingly enough, I know that from one of the public comments we received, and I must say I'm quite surprised, because it's only someone who takes us to the cleaners, who's pointed out there's a potential gap here that we need to look at. So, you know, we'll have to take all of that into account to make sure that we end up with something that isn't easily abused. Again, I come back to it. There are a lot of taxpayers out there. There's a relatively small group of us trying to think through all the consequences. So maybe we missed something, but hopefully not.
I was wondering why the question is, in marketing terms, for instance, that when people are marketing a product, it's not about necessarily the value of the item. It's the ability to market it in such a way that it gains value. So you can produce a good commodity, but if you don't market it properly, you can equally gain very less from that. So the institutions find a way of giving value to an item that doesn't really can serve a valuable price to it. And it's what people do in marketing, right? They're successful with that. So in the professional marketing in Cape Town, for instance, you give all the
That's quite correct. To be honest, my fear in this particular area is exactly the opposite, which is that the manufacturing operation is stripped of its value because the principal pushes an asset into the manufacturing operation and it says, this is my asset, I own it, all you do is you operate it. So you as the manufacturer are entitled to a very, very small profit. Now, that's fine if both entities are in South Africa. If that becomes a cross-border situation, you end up with a transfer pricing problem. So you have stripped value out of the South African operation because you have now become what is known as a toll manufacturer. You are merely an assembler with no intellectual capital of your own and so on. So that is a concern that you would have to also bear in mind here. Your concern is that the value of the asset that is pushed into the particular manufacturer is overstated. Again, there are a set of rules in Section 12C that try to deal with that, to counteract that kind of understatement, because it's not unique here. You could have that in other scenarios too. So short answer is, yes, we are aware of areas where this could be used and value shifted, and we're trying to address them.
Thanks, Chair. Just to follow up on Honourable Sabati's question, and I think the question you asked at the beginning of the session, I looked at this as a non-expert particular example and sort of thought had some similar concerns. It looks like kind of a case where you could create a loophole. I'm not an expert, so I'm not going to express an opinion on that. But it does raise maybe the broader question of how SARS and National Treasury go about identifying the creation of possible loopholes through the proposals brought to the committee. Take an example from a completely different industry. If you have companies creating software, they'll pay people to actually try and find problems with that software, or in fact, when it comes to security software, actually break it. So I just said that because not so many PBO deals with, but the researchers with the BRRR annual report, it's part of the committee oversight to actually consider the strategies of National Treasury and others, and you know, capacity in terms of identifying loopholes and so on could be relevant.
You're referring to the bug bounty that many of the software developing houses have, where essentially they'll pay you a sum of money if you come forward, give you the credit for having found the difficulty and pay it. just to respond to that particular one, it's an interesting concept. Regrettably, I think the amounts of money that are involved in successfully exploiting the loophole are such that we would find it very difficult to create an attractive bug bounty system. Which then brings us to the broader question is, how do we identify the potential for loopholes? Essentially, what happens here is we have an internal process where SARS people look at what we've done and what we're proposing. So first of all, in the drafting team, so Treasury is primarily responsible for the drafting, but we have regular quality assurance meetings where we look at what the drafting has come up with and the policy broadly, and sort of have a team of people who are familiar with what happens in the space look at it and say, okay, if I were on the other side of the table, what would I do to take advantage of this? Those can be quite challenging discussions because you sort of sit there and you test the language and then you try and work out how can we tweak this language so that that doesn't happen? Where are we not expressing ourselves clearly enough? Is there a specific anti-avoidance rule that needs to be written in here? And regrettably, that's one of the reasons why our legislation ends up being longer and more complex than it sometimes we'd like it to be. Because as you go through that process of trying to identify where people would exploit the gap, you say, okay, I need a specific rule here to stop that, and then that might catch a legitimate transaction, so I need an exception to the specific rule that would catch that. If you go to our control foreign corporation rules, you then go to the next level where you have a re-inclusion to the exception because, you, in fact, that may also catch something that you didn't mean to. So it can drive a certain degree of complexity in the system, unfortunately. But now that's the kind of process we follow to try and find the gaps that we're creating, potentially.
With the SECs, which is a responsibility that is driven by the Department of Trade Industry, we responded to provide some tax incentives. We've legislated for this already. It's not in operation yet because we still have to issue regulations. We hope to do that before the end of the year. But at the same time, when we introduced this incentive, we already anticipated, as Francis indicated, there might be a possibility for people circumventing or doing things that is not intended. And here again, it's the relationship between two entities that are related or connected. So whenever you deal with taxes, the related party issue comes up a lot. So when you have an entity based in the SEC that now has a special dispensation of a lower rate and then deals with a company that's not in, you have to be very careful. And this is it's not dissimilar to the issue of transfer pricing between a local company and a national company. What price do they interact? We at one stage explored the possibility of having a domestic transfer pricing regime. We explored the possibility of having a domestic transfer pricing regime, like that. Seemed to be too complicated. So we came up with a pretty simple rule that say if two connected parties interact with a debtor and the deduction related to that transaction is more than 20% of the expenditure incurred by the company located in the SEZ, that company will be disqualified from the issue. So that's what we've got. So you'll see on the left-hand side would be a company that has a gross income of, say, $5 million, a deductible expense of $3.5 million, tax income of $1.5 million. The tax rate will be 50% within the SEZ. The tax liability will be 25%. However, if there was a transaction between with this company located in the SEZ and another company, and that amounts to an excess of 20%, which in this case, example of $1.5 million being the case, that company will be disqualified from getting the benefit of a lower rate and will be taxed at 28%. I think we've
also use a different example. You've got 1.5 million appearing twice, and it's a bit confusing. You should have used something different.
Well, I'm not the chair. The chair says I'm indicating that she's going to come back in the flesh. So, I suggest that you continue with other members of the question.
So that's it. It's more than this, but it's an entry avoidance provision. No. If there was a related party transaction, related party transaction, they could exceed 20% of the turnover in the sector.
It's
20% reasonable. Sorry. So the question is 20% reasonable, and that's what you will hear from the hearing, so the people who accept 20% might be too onerous.
Just come back to
tax policy. So here you have one where two things are in conflict. So we have simplicity. 20% is an easy rule. Everyone understands it. Yes, but then you open the scope for abuse further. Whereas the other option that we did, one of the other options we looked at was a domestic transfer pricing system. Well, yes, that then is probably a more efficient and accurate basis for doing it, but it increases the complexity and reduces the certainty. So they're your trade-offs that you're looking at. So this is a simple rule. We'll probably hear from people that I think 20% is workable. If it's unworkable, then we'd have to look at some alternative answer. You know, maybe it's 25%. Maybe it is we have to go back to the concept of domestic transfer pricing. Maybe it's some third option that someone smarter than I am can come up with.
We can't keep it simple
and come up with a figure which we think is fairly reasonable. We have to see what the case is. Okay. The next one is government grants. And here, our sister department, especially the DPI, they've got various grants which they give by and incentivize various initiatives. And we had various provisions in the tax law that deals with these grants from a tax perspective. A few years ago, 2012, we consolidated into one Schedule 11 schedule and list all of these grants and say from an income tax perspective, when you receive the grant, which is not taxable, but neither can you claim a deduction because you've now got it from government, you're not going to tax on it, but you also can't claim an expense, otherwise you get double benefit. Once you claim an expense, you get an additional 28% benefit of it. We dealt with the PPP slightly different in a different section because the PPP is a different concept of normal type of grants. And within the PPP environment, we didn't have this particular provision. All we now do is to also include any grants or contribution government makes towards a PPP project would be a gram in the hands of the parties. But equally, they can't claim it as a deduction or a depreciation purposes to prevent so-called double dipping. Not completely double, but okay. Then moving on to the UDZ. The UDZ initiative was introduced in 2003, especially within our interaction with Johannesburg to try and revitalize the inner city. So what can you do from a tax perspective? Obviously, the municipality has to do quite a lot themselves, but from an income tax perspective, what can we do to assist them? And so there we say, look, what you want to do is to refurbish existing buildings or maybe get a new building in. Buildings are normally written off over a period of 20 years. And we said, again, it's a depreciation, it's a fixed asset that you, normally buildings last for more than 20 years, but for tax purposes, you can write it off for 20 years. And so let's say, let's allow a write-off over a shorter period that improve the cash flow of the entity. And that's the regime that we have. So on the next slide, you'll see
that that's the type of allowances that we have now, and we allow for a much shorter period for depreciation, both in terms of improvement and also new buildings. The 60 municipalities that are listed in the Act are the, sort of the larger municipalities. These are the municipalities that qualify. There are, over the years, we've been approached by other municipalities that want to be added to the list, but not comment on that. Then we've done a study on the effectiveness of UDZ in the next slide. And as that well, the UDZ itself is not a main contributor towards revitalizing the city. It does make a contribution, it does make a marginal contribution. So people will not necessarily only see the UDZ as a main carrot. The municipality needs to come to the party. So there has been some indication that the incentive on the margin makes a contribution towards. So we said, let's keep it alive then. So what we are proposing, if we go back to slide 59, is two proposals. One is that we allow municipalities of a certain size to have more than one UDZ. And the cut point was 2 million. Now we're saying we bring that down to 1 million, and also if the population is still below 1 million, we give the minister discretion, the criteria that we will develop to extend the UDZ for municipalities that have population of less than 1 million. And the reason why we've done this is that with the amalgamation of various municipalities, the city centers of the municipalities is not as in old days when it was one city center. You've got probably municipalities with three or four city centers. The question is, which one do you identify? Obviously, you can't give to everybody, but you need to be flexible. So that's the main reason for this.
Okay. Then the I'm
not sure there's any questions because we're moving now to a different part.
Maybe the political question. I want to know that when we choose the list of municipalities in the manner in which we choose, where it's like a very urban municipalities that qualifies for this, are we not perpetuating development to be always in the city centers and incentivizing municipalities that in a way, you know, afford to do certain things as opposed to the poorest municipalities. You know, it's like when you want to have an automobile plant to take it to Joburg, when you can go and create jobs in far-flung areas where they are needed most, and you know, stuff like that. How is it to have a development in South Africa? And that's my personal opinion. If you look at how the Chinese do it, you will go to some rural area, but there will be some economic activities happening there because of the intention to do that, to decentralize investment, to even go to, I don't know.
We have tried to capture that. We've got some of the smaller municipalities on this list. Now, obviously, there are other municipalities one could add to this, and that would be a next reform that we want to suggest to the minister is to, depending on the request that comes from the municipality, that the minister can develop some criteria to add more municipalities. There might be these rural municipalities, but there needs to be some criteria, because you can't give it all around the same income in the municipality.
Just a few points. One is, remember what this is trying to do. It's trying to take some existing infrastructure that has fallen into disuse and bring it back into use. You've got a massive sunk cost that society has put into some of these areas where that infrastructure is now sitting lying idle. So you want to bring that back into use. It's there, and that's why if you have a look at this particular slide, you'll see the improvements are treated more generously than anew. Because what you want is you want the existing infrastructure to be brought back into use. So that's what this is trying to achieve. If you can look at the industrial development zones, many of them are trying to achieve what you're suggesting, is to try and get some economic growth going in areas where currently there isn't as much as we would like. So slightly different directions and slightly different instruments that are being used, just to supplement what Cecil said.
But we will work with our Intergov people to develop some criteria. I mean, one municipality that have already approached us, okay, they also want to come to the list, and currently we don't have to do that. So saying, okay, first the minister, we will develop criteria and say, at your discretion, can add to the list.
So just back to the I spoke to my conceptual issues that you raised at the end of the workshop. Now that I'm on the tax incentives, I mean, there's obviously two important issues for public finance oversight. The one is the foregone revenue that results from tax incentives, and then the other is whether the behavioural objectives are achieved. So with say with the UDZ, you've got a firm that would previously have located outside of the UDZ, and they would have a depreciation allowance that would determine a certain amount of tax they would pay. They'll now, hopefully, if the intention is they'll locate in the UDZ, they'll have a reduced amount of tax they have to pay, which means revenue collection will go down, but other parts of the objectives will be achieved. I appreciate that the behavioural outcome is very hard to predict for anybody, but I guess just the issue of foregone revenue is obviously important to the committee. I don't know if the colleagues can talk about that at all.
There is a reduced tax in the short term, but I think there's an increased tax in the long term because your deductions tail off, and so in the end you're paying more tax because once you've recovered the cost or the assets depreciated, there's nothing more to deduct from taxable income. So it's an incentive to save money in the short term, save tax in the short term, but in the long term, the tax rate might be pushed up, and you might end up paying more tax than you would otherwise have paid. So, you know, it's not what's the zero-sum gain or whatever it is for revenue. They'll catch up later. And then in terms of the UDZ take-up, am I right, and there's not a complete municipality that's qualified? I mean, it's portions.
Yeah, I think both those comments are important comments. I think the nice thing about the depreciation allowance is it impacts on the cash flow of the business. And if you work out the internal rate of return, that helps you in the beginning. But I think the number is right in the sense that once you've written it off, your taxable income increases in the later stage. And so the risk to the fiscus of a depreciation regime is one of the minimum risks that we can deal with effectively. So that's why we prefer that rather than all sorts of other things. Yes, the determination of the area, there's a size restriction and a number of units, and that is up to the municipality to decide. You just put the overall cap and they need to decide which one they want. Okay.
Even that depends on really. I think the UDZ is crucial really. It's not mutually exclusive to what Sandy is saying.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at the success story, Johannesburg CBD, look where it was 10 years ago, look where it is now. In fact, Joburg has been, you know, quite an inspiration to other municipalities. Where the inner cities also, I mean, the main victims there have been poor in the working class. I mean, their conditions are horrific, right? But of course, when you get all this investment, interestingly, they get ousted. And the people who moved into the Joburg CBD are the new hippie, new hip sort of generation, new people, if you look at Maulay and so on, right? I know in a previous life I played an active role in this, is part of my ministry, and I visited many of these municipalities. And in fact, COXA, I don't know if you know, was also encouraging, I think, your minister at the time to encourage this property. I think it happened even before 2009. So Masondo has done superb work there, and other municipalities. So actually, what Kandi is saying is correct, but what you're doing here is not, it's complementary to what you're saying. I think we've done very good work, and it helps that you have had the tax incentives first. Over to Kandi.
As part of a follow-up or should I call other things, the
only in CBDs. You do have them in other peri-urban areas. In my hometown, for instance, there's a lot of factories that are abandoned and rebound, and, you know, not only industrial size, but other business size that can be revamped. You have shop closing down and many other things. So it's not only in the urban areas where there's assets. I was saying just as part of the action.
Not really sure. I think, I mean, if the UNIZET could potentially be extended to these municipalities, I think these municipalities, once we've developed this criteria, maybe next year, and legislate for it, they could approach that. That's one avenue. I think one must be also cautious that we had in under the previous regime, this decentralization policies, that created infrastructure which don't really make economic sense. And it will be very difficult to revive that going forward because it's not sustainable. Yeah, that's why it lost. Yeah. And it's very hard to revitalize those particular areas because, number one, those areas should probably never have had those investments because it's not economically sustainable. I mean, you can't stop the process of urbanization. As the economy develops, urbanization will happen. Need to accept that and deal with rural development from a slightly different perspective. To try and prop up rural development with infrastructure that is not sustainable, as per the country. That's my question to Mr. Texio.
We have an incident of development framework. And we say there that the focus on urban development is actually meant to stimulate rural development. You can't separate the two. They're almost dialectically related, right? They interconnectedness and so on. And I'm saying that I understand what you're saying, but the policy frameworks of the government are actually moving towards saying urbanization, yes, but in a way that also stimulates rural development and so on, because of the constraints also in managing the influx of people. So, I think everybody, the whole world is urbanized. Mm. I think more than half the world's population live in urban areas. And the projections are in our own country. Mm. By 2050 or something, I've forgotten the figures. It's going to be remarkable.
All right. Oh. Just in your example of China and Brazil and the anger bar, frankly, that, as it happens, wasn't an ideological one. That was the water and the Moy River and the textile industry. And it was the whole collapse of the textile industry that results in that. But I do take your point. I think absolutely, if you look at Irakini outside Laysan, my hometown, I mean, it was an ideological stupidity of gross proportions and now is decrepit, and there's no point in it. Although there are hundreds of thousands of people who live around, they said that labor was huge.
No, I did say my question was political. No wonder it's where it is now. That's no wonder it's where it is now, but it's okay.
Thanks, Chair. The next one is really an incentive which is run by the PTI, and they've approached us to do two things. One is to extend the date of when this incentive comes to an end, and also to look at administration of the incentive in terms of reporting. One is pretty just the alignment of reporting,
that one is easier to do extended. They also requested us to up the amount, which we said at this stage we will not be able to do, and they engaged that with the budget process. So just to give some background, the Zapper policy looked at applications, they score various proposals, and these are just the type of scores in terms of does this investment, is it innovative, improve energy efficiency, business linkages, small business, skills development, green capital. These are some of the criteria they develop to score. And then that qualifying status of the preferred status, and they depend on the quantum of the tax relief that you get. I think the DGI has reported that to Parliament, I'm not sure if this committee or their own committee, on the progress that has been made in terms of applications. This is not necessarily investments, these are approved projects, and there's quite a delay between projects that's been approved and tax investments. So these are just indicating of the type of project that's been approved. They also have where these projects are and so on. The next slide just shows you the complications that we have with reporting. So when the persons can claim the allowances after the investment has been made, you will find that you have to start reporting actually before you made the investment. So that becomes problematic. And so what we basically now are doing is that the compliance period you move, it happens after you've made the investment, because you can only really measure the impact of the investment after it's been made, not after it's been approved. So it's just an admin issue. That's really two small issues there. Then the next one also an alignment. Duncan, you want to talk to this one?
The next one is an alignment of depreciation allowance. But this is based on the person who's renting the IRU in the right of use of this transmission line. Currently, the industry, there are transmission lines from South Africa mainly to Dubai and offshore. And in 2009, changes were made in the Act to say that if you are renting this, that rental income is treated as a tax deduction. So what happens is that it was limited to a period, like to say 20 years, and it's not limited to the agreement. So now it has come to our attention that the industry practice of the depreciation period of these cables is not 20 years anymore, it's 15 years, based on the fact that they become damaged with this short period of time because they're in the waterways and all that. So last year we made changes in domestic legislation to say that the right of use for electronic cables but inside South Africa is reduced for 20 years to 15 years, that is the term for the depreciation. So in this one, we are aligning what we have in the domestic line to the offshore submarine cables to say we are reducing the period from 20 years to 15 years. That's what it is.
The next one is, again, this sort of deals with two issues, really. One is the issue of environmental and climate and energy, and these things are pretty integrated. A few years ago, we had an accelerated depreciation for renewable energy. I think you can write it up over 3 years, 50, 30, 20. That was to encourage the uptake of investments in the renewable energy project. That has taken off quite well, not because of the incentive, but more as a result of the program that's been run by the Department of Energy in conjunction with national strategy colleagues. But I think the incentive has helped to improve the cash flow of these businesses, and one of the success stories in this country, really. We've looked at how one can look at this further, and there is a reasonable potential, people argue, for solar PV rooftop projects, which are small type investments. And here we're just proposing that instead of the 3 years, we can write it off over 1 year for small investments. And hopefully that will encourage investments in this particular area. Then next one, Chair, is related, but a slightly different angle. So when we started to work on climate change and work with the Department of Environmental Affairs,
with the various environmental fiscal reform measures and the research that we are doing on the carbon tax, and we will probably come to the Security later this year with the draft carbon tax bill. And at the time we did the carbon tax discussion, we said, look, one of the low-hanging fruits for both an energy perspective and a climate perspective is the issue of energy utilization, energy efficiency. And by all measures, this country was not high on the energy efficiency area. And we probably will expand on this in more detail when you discuss the carbon tax. And so we said, let's work on the carbon tax, but provide some carrot in the meantime and encourage businesses to become more energy efficient. In that process, they save energy, but also reduce carbon, because our energy mix are pretty carbon intensive. It took us quite a long time to get a reasonable system in place. We eventually published the regulations in November 2013, and since November 2013, this has been in place. The cents, we converted into a cents per kilowatt hour. It was not only electricity, it was all forms of energy, but technically you can convert it to a cent per kilowatt hour. And so the incentive was a reduction of 45 cents. We now propose to increase that from 45 cents to 95 cents. As from, I think, the beginning of the fiscal year, if the committee, parliament approved. In addition, although not technically an energy efficiency matter, there has been quite a lot of discussion about cogeneration. And unfortunately, on the cogeneration side, not much progress has been made, and I think the Department of Energy will pretty soon come up with some mechanism to encourage cogeneration. But we said, okay, let's include cogeneration as part of this incentive mechanism. So cogeneration projects will now also qualify. This is a little bit of a history on where the incentive is. It's in part of the Income Tax Act. It will run from 2013 until 2020. And hopefully by then, most of the companies will have taken up this and that might probably not need it anymore, but we will review it by the time. There's a very strong measuring, monitoring, and verification process. It's administered by SANERI, which is an agency of the Department of Energy, the approval process. And we see this is part of the carbon tax rebate and start recycling the revenue even before we've actually collected the revenue. So we convoluted, right? That is the hopeful. There's an incentive will take off and we can compensate for the impact of the carbon tax. Just a brief indication about, I think this is data we got from SANERI about 6 months ago, is that there are already registered users. This is an internet-based system they have, about 74 projects, quite a lot of kilowatt hours saved there. And there are also creditors, because that's one of the issues that you need to have people to go and verify whether the savings are activated. Just in terms of sectors of projects that has been applied for at the time, within mining sector it was 28, agriculture 3, industrial 20, commercial 21, and even in the transport sector. And I think now that we have the quantum of the relief, this will be quite significant. In France, maybe you should just talk about one example that you mentioned to me.
I think the example I mentioned to Hessel is we've seen one that is for a very substantial amount of money, but I think that sums that up even better than I ever could, because if you're looking at 3,826 megawatt hours and you convert that at 95 cents per kilowatt hour, you begin to see the scale of what's on the offer here.
So there are quite a couple of quite big projects that is applying for this, and we will see the fiscal impact probably as from next year. We haven't yet, so the fiscal impact we'll probably see this year. And we will be able to quantify it as a tax expenditure in the report as such in the budget documentation. So that's really what we're doing here. We've amended the regulations to accommodate cogeneration. And the bill now is just the thing of the rate. We should have actually included it in the rates bill, but for various reasons we decided to include it in Chile, but not in the rates bill. Any question there?
I'm not sure. It was just a time issue. I think maybe we wanted to do the regulation in X period of time, but there was no policy, major policy issue. But we're going to backdate it. From the 1st of April. I think the law is that it will be once approved, it will apply retrospectively from the 1st of April.
The Councilman points out that the 3,826 megawatt is significant in financial terms, but when this was introduced or mooted, what were the expectations? What were the budget implications that were determined at that time, and are we now way behind, way over in terms of that 3,000?
That's very difficult. When you introduce this scheme, when we did an analysis, all we witnessed is two things. One is South African economy is very energy inefficient, and our energy is pretty, pretty high in terms of carbon. And so to achieve both objectives, you need to address not only pricing carbon, but you need to encourage people to make use of the low-hanging fruits, because there is an hurdle that people don't see the benefit immediately. And therefore, there is an encouragement to do that, because in the interest of the country globally. So it is very hard to predict it. All we know that this is an important policy initiative to go. We've put a time limit to encourage people to take it up. We have no idea about how many people will take it up. It was so at the beginning. There's still a problem with small businesses because the cost of their education is quite high. And so what we're working with Saneri is a more simplified verification process for certain small projects. And we can do that by regulations, and hopefully we can do that next year.
I just wanted to ask whether is there tax incentives for households on energy saving? I'm interested to know whether the mining sector will we monitor the mining sector, because it's been the one that has been using a lot of energy. Will there be a system that shows us the changes as and when they happen over time, something like that?
The last question, I think if you go to slide 52. Like we did with the ST chair that came to present the last time about how the research and development incentive works, it might be an opportune to, within a year's time, to invite Saneri to come and present on this stuff. We can get more detailed stuff, so Saneri would be able to give you a lot more micro detail. Obviously, for confidentiality purposes, we won't be able to list the name of the companies, but we probably can break down the mining sector by the type of mineral. And that should be possible. On the households, that's a difficult one. SARS doesn't like incentives through the tax system for individuals. It just complicates their life too much. So we've got savings, medical, and that's enough. We don't want more than that. So what we've done with household is strategy was an on-budget provision for solar water heaters, for example. Now, there's been some successes there and some failures, but I think we need to look at the on-budget allocation and grants to individuals and also to municipalities. And I think if the committee wants to maybe get some feedback, you should ask our public finance team to brief you on the successes they've achieved there.
Thanks, sir. So just to chip in again, because last week, as you're aware, we presented to the Committee on Funding of State-Owned Enterprises. We've also received a request from the Appropriations Committee to look at Eskom's finances following on the Eskom appropriation bills. So I think, you know, an obvious issue to raise is sort of coordination around these particular incentives. I mean, in the current context, National Treasury has made some estimates of the impact of load shedding on the economy, and based on that, you'd actually argue that there is a case for increasing the incentive because the social and state benefit to avoid load shedding is a lot higher. At the same time, the behavioral effect is going to shift people toward alternative energy uses, and you would hope that Eskom is taking that into account in terms of its former customer base. So this has implications for future public finance in other areas as well. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Right. I think there is a lot of work people do in the background to say what is Eskom's load program, and given the load shedding, given the need for renewable energy, apart from load shedding, the, you know, climate change and all sorts of things. So that Eskom needs to build that in, that, so that they don't sit with stranded assets in 10 years' time that people are sort of partially off the grid. So I think they need to take that into account. People will move that direction in any case. So it's up to them to make sure that they plan for that eventuality that it will happen. Okay. Then the last one, Ms. Shanga, I think you should probably talk to this one also. It's filaments. So you, did you drop from the slide? Okay. This is a small change. Okay, so we just got this one, Jim. Okay.
The next one on international taxation, the theme here is to address the issue of base erosion and profit shifting, and also relax the tax changes we made in 2013 to address this issue, because the tax changes we made in 2013 were hampering non-state businesses. So we are relaxing the tax changes we made in 2013, at the same time introducing other countermeasures so that when we relax, people don't use the loopholes. So that's what we normally do. We relax and then produce more measures for loopholes, and then people will say that the measures for the loopholes are too punitive, they hamper and affect their businesses. The current proposal occurs during the cost issue of shares. And the cost issue of shares occurs during cross-border company formations. For instance, let's say when a South African company acquires a target foreign company, it will issue its own shares to that foreign target company and instead of paying for cash. Instead of paying shares for cash, like you say, you want to get shares in target foreign company, but instead of paying cash for those shares in a foreign target company, I'll issue shares in my South African company as a consideration. The end result is that the foreign target company will own shares in a South African company, and the South African company will own shares in a foreign target company. So that is a cross issue of shares in that context. Prior to 2013, the above mentioned cross issue of shares not subject to tax, and the policy rationale was to allow a suitable environment for cross-border company formation. So this is the structure that was envisaged. That is, that said that a South African company will acquire a target foreign company and buy shares in a target foreign company, but instead of paying for cash, it will issue shares in its own South African company. So we go to slide 2. Because the cross issue of shares was not subject to tax, because we wanted more company formation so that business can grow, our South African company can expand, what happened is that taxpayers used this for tax-free company migration. They shift the profit offshore so that they are not taxed in South Africa. So you are here in step one. Here is a South African company having a foreign subco, which is an African company. And here is a foreign company with a foreign subco. And then cross-issue shares happens by a South African company will acquire shares in a foreign company, and the foreign company will acquire shares in a South African company. By doing so, indirectly, the foreign company acquires shares in an African subsidiary of a South African company, and South African company acquires shares in a foreign subsidiary of a foreign company, because you acquire shares and also indirectly acquire shares in companies underneath. Now, the second step that will happen is that the South African company will sell the shares in a foreign subco after the first year using participation exemption. If you sell at least 20% of your shares in a foreign subco, there is no tax. There is no capital gains tax, because the reason for the participation exemption was that dividends from offshore, if you own more than 10%, if you own at least 10% of the company issuing the dividends, the dividends are exempt from tax, because we wanted people to bring money back in the country. And in turn, so we know that, okay, if dividends are exempt, then the sale of shares, because the shares produce exempt income, then they should be exempt. So the participation exemption was both for the dividends and for the sale of shares. So the step here was that the South African company will sell the shares in the foreign subco, and thereby 40% sell all the shares free of tax, because there is a participation exemption. And then they go to the step 3, whereby the tax-free company migrations, whereby now the South African company no longer owns the shares in a foreign company. And now the foreign company owns most of the shares in a South African company. So we find that now the South African company is mostly foreign owned based on the taxi company migration. Go to the next slide. So what happened is that Sakya said that the 2013 changes, although they were in good faith because they prevented base erosion and profit shifting, however, they were humbling for non-state businesses. So before the budget this year, there was an article in Financial News, Taxpayers reporting saying that if we do not address this is hampering for non-state businesses. So luckily enough, it was on the budget. So we said that now, because the 2013 changes are affecting non-state businesses, we're going to reverse the 2013 changes. So if you go to the example one in the slide one, whereby they copy your shares, that one, still go back to the old policy rationale that the cost issue of shares, there's no capital gain tax on the cost issue of shares. However, because in order to counter the tax free corporate migrations and profit shifting, he came out now with two measures that will stop the corporate migrations because people are using the cost issue, the tax free cost issue of shares. So we're saying that if now you've done the cost issue of shares, there's no, you won't get participation exemption. If after you've done those issue of shares in year one, so in year two, before the 3 years, you sell your company, your foreign company, then you won't get the participation exemption because, meaning that you've done the first issue of shares only for selling. So there's a waiting period of 3 years. However, if you sell after 3 years, then your participation exemption will get it. It won't reverse. That's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to relax the rules that we introduced in 2016, but at the same time, bring again counter tax avoidance rules so that the people do not do corporate migration.
Chair, I'm not sure whether the reversal intention is the best way of dealing with it. Maybe, and that's my opinion, maybe companies should have been given a particular time frame to operate tax-free in terms of their participation as suppliers in foreign companies, and over a period of time then they are put back into the system where they can pay taxes. And I'm saying this because I'm just thinking about new incumbents. If there's a disadvantaged group that wants to have shareholdership in a foreign company to generate revenue to be able to sustain themselves, the company, will this reversal not affect those who are new in the system, who are new entrants? I like it when you limit shareholdership by foreign companies, African companies, which tend to be above 10%. But have you also researched a situation where, let's say, a South African company can hold 10% shareholdership in 5 to 10 foreign companies to remain on the tax-free package? It might have happened. For instance, while we say you can give us in percentage terms how many companies had shareholdership in offshore companies impeding on the bona fide formations that needs to benefit more. We don't have that in presentation, how many companies are doing that. But I'm saying the new entrants that want to do that, we can have a regime that says we allow it maybe for 1, 2, 3 years. After that, you have had your profits, and then you move from that bracket to a different bracket, and so that we don't stop those new companies who are forming and wanting to own shares offshore, participating, especially those companies when there's saturation in the South African market and people see offshore opportunities and they want to make investments offshore, and there's a limitation, and they don't carry enough capital to do it in a situation where there will be capital gains in posting, if you get the point I'm trying to make. So,
writing a letter to ministers. I've just got an email about next week, and we have to apply quickly for exemption. I discussed this, Alan, I presume it'll be your best last night and brief, David, so I'm not covering that. So I have to apply now, and we're trying to merge the two programs to use them quickly, so that we don't sit at the media workshop unproductive instead of being here next week.
No, they asked us to seek exemptions from meetings. Don't get involved in administration, Francis. It's a nightmare. That's exactly the point, right?
I don't want to be the same.
Half the thing, but I'm working here. Right. Next, Alfie, has something to say? Okay, good. Right, over to you.
Thanks, Honourable Member. The changes we made by voting the 2018 changes allows new entrants, as you rightly say, that you don't want to hamper company formations because the market in South Africa is saturated. Hence, now we are saying that when you do that, whether new entrants like everyone, then on the cross issue, on the initial cross issue of shares, there's no tax. So new entrants can come in even. However, if it's in 3 years after you've done that cross issue, in 3 years, you sell your shares in the South African company, then that's when the tax is triggered. So, but now there's no tax, but you must sell after 3 years. That the limitation is imposed. Okay, the next issue is a small issue, but a very important issue for also our tax treaty partners. What happens is that in 2011, South Africa introduced a special foreign tax credit regime dealing with foreign withholding taxes imposed in respect of services fees. The regime was intended to operate as some of relief from double taxation on cross-border services for South African multinational companies that render services in their foreign subsidiaries. The main concern here was our tax treaty country partners that were not applying the tax treaty correctly. For instance, the tax treaty will have no article dealing with withholding tax on services. However, the domestic law has provisions dealing with withholding tax on services. So instead of our tax treaty country partners applying the tax treaty, they'll apply the domestic law. And then, so this measure was meant for that. That is, when the tax treaty five countries have applied the domestic law, we give that. However, this was against the general international principles because the tax treaty country partner does not even have the right to tax that. So what we are saying is that we are repeating what we have done in 2011 because it also imposes a significant compliance burden for SARS. And also the Davis Tax Committee, the interim report, also highlighted this, that this is against the international tax law. So we are reversing that. And then we are saying that If the tax treaty country partner has wrongly imposed the withholding tax on services, we are asking the special agreement procedure system in terms of the MEP, meaning that those taxpayers will go to SARS and SARS will conduct the tax treaty country partner the revenue authority, and then they solve the issue through mutual agreement procedure. And with all the issue of the G20 work on exchange of information, we think that, and also the African Tax Administration Forum, we think that there is more cooperation now between revenue authorities, that we think can be solved through the mutual agreement procedure rather than just certification, which is against the international tax principles.
Yeah, you see, several things that you've been raising, right? It's very hard for me, at least, to judge whether it's the correct thing you're doing or not. I mean, unless you have the technical expertise, and unless you worked on issues with a wide range of stakeholders, actually it's very hard to judge these things. And the more details you get, and the more intricately involved you get in the issue, the more it strikes me how difficult it is for a parliamentary committee to exercise effective oversight over these tax proposals you come with. I don't think it's peculiar to us here in this country. I suspect in some other form, it's a more general problem that MPs have in, you know, most parliaments in the world. Mainly the U.S. system where they have the average MP has like 18 to 22 Congress people have researchers. Or in the U.K. when we went there once, they thought they had 9 researchers. But at a time when we were sharing researchers about 10 to 15 years ago. So, you know, even there, I don't think, unless you're in the tax field, unless you get a tax expert, you know, very hard. We asked actually for our content advisor. And in fact, let me switch this off.
the content side of the attack surface. That's where you are.
All right, over to people who want to comment.
But I really feel quite, let's say, unable. You may well be right. I don't know. But I'm sure we can suggest otherwise. We just take it.
Yeah, this is actually, I mean, concept-wise, this is a simple issue. What happens here is that another country withhold certain taxes which they are now entitled to because the service is provided in South Africa, and they then withhold tax. Our business has complained that they are being taxed twice, and we need to give them relief. We were sympathetic, and I think we're wrongly sympathetic, to provide them relief from outside, whereas we should have gone to the country and said, well, you're not entitled to this tax. You must give them, in terms of the BTA agreement, a relief. So I think if we were over hastily doing something we should never have done here. You probably have seen some of these BTA agreements being presented to the committee that we signed. I'm not sure what we do with countries where we don't have BTAs, because there is a different story. I'm not sure what you do there.
All right, so if you don't have you have a DTA, you don't have a DTA, then strictly speaking, again, by international tax principle, they should not be taxing it. So that remains a given, that they shouldn't be taxing it. We don't have a treaty mechanism to assist, but you're still left with the thorny question of why does the South African FISC subsidize the other country that is taxing outside of the framework? So the middle ground that is struck there, then, is we allow the foreign taxes a deduction, not as a credit. So it's a lesser form of relief, but there is still some relief for the taxpayer that finds themselves caught in this crossfire. So we then partially come to the table on it, and we give them a deduction, not a credit.
All right, when
I used to do international trade in the GTI, one of my gripes was that the South African businesses, when they do business outside South Africa, they tend not to involve government so that government can be able to help in situations of the state of wasteland where there's no a treaty between ourselves, South Africa, and a country, and they end up having challenges. For instance, if you look at South African, I mean the Chinese business, they will tend to follow the policies of their government, and once there is that relationship between their government and a particular country, it helps them to relate with those businesses. So when we had trade missions, they've always encouraged companies to be part of it, so that we're not only consulted when there are challenges. With so many cases where we got involved in rogue investments and we had to intervene because South African companies. So I know it's very difficult to look at every transaction that happens where companies individually go and make deals and so on. But if it can be fashionable to South African businesses to work with governments, it makes it easier for us, I assume. So it's how we're going to build that relationship over time with South African businesses, particularly as the Department of Trade and Industry and International Relations, that's to harmonize. I can cite many examples, like the government sector having problems somewhere, we have to intervene, you know, many, many instances where such interventions were made. So I think this is the most important decision we've taken to I asked a question yesterday on trade, for instance, where I said, how does the OECD harmonize even tax that goes into agreements? Because you might find that the interpretation of tax by other countries might not be the same as us. And the only recourse when you go to the United Nations to intervene, which is a very long process, a very expensive process to do certain investigations. In this case, we're dealing with tax avoidance, where you want exchange of information, but there's more to it than just that. It's even then, and it's normal. A particular country wants to protect its own business against foreign investors. You know, in a way, and it's not everybody who plays on a playing field. I will answer by saying we discourage our Asian companies to invest in countries where they don't have a treaty, for instance. But it's not possible, right? Individuals, you know, you put in things and measures you want to control, blah, 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 you know. So, yeah.
In a way, is there any obligation on SARS to assist the affected taxpayer, both in the instance of the treaty or without treaty?
Let me take the last question. If there's a treaty, yes, there is an obligation on us to assist. That is the mutual agreement procedure. You take it up with what's known as the competent authority at SARS, and then it is our obligation to then go and engage with the competent authority on the other side to resolve the issue of double taxation. Now, both are sovereign states, and this speaks to the first point that was made, so nobody can force a result, but we have a treaty, we are meant to interpret that treaty in good faith and come to a conclusion. So I will say that we are generally successful in having these reversed, where it's in contravention of the treaty. So we sometimes can be a fairly long process because bureaucracy sometimes moves quite slowly on either side. We like to think it's because the other side's bureaucracy moves slower than us. But it's a generally successful mechanism for resolving the problem. What business doesn't like about it is it sometimes takes quite a while to get to the end result. I would make the point, though, that once you've had the first positive result, the second one's a lot easier. Whereas this kind of solution doesn't create incentive for the other side to move because, well, the problem's been solved. South Africa gave up its taxing rights. What's the issue? When there isn't a treaty, well, no, then we don't have mechanism to engage. So there is no responsibility for SARS to attempt to resolve the issue. But that's why Section 6.1c exists, where it says, okay, we can't give you a credit because this is outside of the international framework. If it was within the international framework and we didn't have a DK, we would give you a credit. So we're actually quite generous that way in South Africa. Some countries would only give you the credit if there was a treaty, but we have what's known as a unilateral tax credit. But if it's outside of that framework, some countries again would say, well, that's too bad then. You know, you took the business decision to do business in that country. You suffered the consequences. You knew full well there wasn't a DTA. That is essentially your problem. In South Africa, we have been somewhat more generous. You know, we've said, okay, we can't rise to the level of giving you a credit. In other words, you had to pay 10 rand worth of tax on the other side. In South Africa, you had to pay 12 rand tax. We'll give you a credit of 10, and you only have to pay 2 to South Africa. What we will instead do is we will give you a deduction for the foreign tax. So essentially, we'll give you, if you're a company, 38% of the foreign tax back. That's the best we can do since we're outside the international framework and there is no DTA. So that's what the legislation brings us to be. On the question of consistency of interpretation, that is quite a challenge. What assists in that regard is that you have what are known as the commentaries to the model tax conventions. So you have the OECD commentary and the United Nations commentary. And those two commentaries do not have direct authority in courts, but they are usually considered to be useful guides for the interpretation of the agreements in terms of the Vienna Convention and other frameworks for interpretation. So courts will generally try to follow interpretation that is consistent with the treaty and the commentaries. They may find a good reason not to, but generally they will try and follow those interpretations precisely to get that kind of commonality of understanding. Because you'll appreciate a treaty meant to be bilateral, So if the one country is interpreting it one way and the other country is interpreting it a completely different way, it's not bilateral in the full sense of the word anymore. You have a mismatch. And I'm clearly, of course, are aware of that and do try and take it into account.
Nope. Right. Next issue, please.
International practice whereby you've got a residence-based system of taxation, because you do not want residents shifting income to the controlled foreign companies and then are not subject to tax in South Africa. So South Africa has got, similar to other countries, South Africa has got controlled foreign company provisions. This is a difficult set of provisions, as Francis said, that you have exemption and there will be exception to the exemption. So these rules were introduced in 1997, and when we moved to residence-based system of taxation in 2001, the rules were modified to mimic the residence-based system of taxation. So in 2011, we made some changes in the Act, as we normally say, that we make things in that were helping the taxpayer, and find that things, the changes that were made premature, that we've made are premature. So we've made changes whereby we removed certain rules that dealing with sale of goods by NDFC, by South African company to an offshore, inbound sale of goods. However, when we made these changes, we thought that the transfer pricing rules will be more effective. But the problem with transfer pricing rules is like audit. You look at the transactions. And yet the CSC provisions are charging provisions. Like, if now you have sold goods to an offshore company, then you apply the rules immediately, and then you look at the transaction. Whereas the transfer price, you look at a general audit, like you look at what happened, prices between private persons and all that. So in 2011, we removed these rules. So now, the removal of these rules is made the South African tax system less effective in addressing the issue of profit shifting. We have said that the CFC rules are anti-avoidance rules, specific anti-avoidance rules aimed at the transaction of the sale of outbound goods. So what we are doing now, we are bringing back those rules that were removed in 2011 in the same form as they were before 2011. That's all we are doing.
That's interesting. Any comments? Hello? Next issue, please.
Small changes to the VAT system. We haven't done major changes to the VAT system for quite a while, except when we introduced external e-services, and it's seeing that New Zealand is now following us. So we adopted the VAT system from New Zealand, and now they're following us. So,
is it trans that went to New Zealand? Is it trans that went to New Zealand?
He's an electronic offer. So, let it come, the best it works on the invoice basis. So when you issue an invoice, you need to account for that, the value of the invoice or payment, the VAT says. And that's how most VAT system works. You can also have a VAT based on a cash basis, that you only account for the VAT when the actual cash is paid. And as we said last time, the chair, is that with the difficulty that the SABC is experiencing in terms of tracing people, really, and people disappearing from their radar screen, issuing, sending invoices, and can't trace these people, they have to account for VAT. SARS has tried to help them administratively for some time, but I think that administrative ruling is problematic for us, and so we provide a legal framework
to allow them to make a choice between the invoice basis or the cash basis. Obviously, they can't have both. They can't have certain parts on invoice basis and other parts on the cash basis. So instead of sort of dictating what they should do, we leave it up to them. And I think we should try to explain to them, it's not sort of special if you treat them differently, it's just that the nature of the activity involved is complicated. There's a whole question about the efficacy of TV license, but that's a different debate. We'll probably deal with that. Okay. I'm sure there's any questions. Then, again, here a few years ago, we thought it might be helpful to zero rate certain housing grants, especially sort of the RDP housing type of grants, to increase the benefit thereof. But the administration of this particular provision it's become a bit of a nightmare for SAS, and they can't get their handle on it. And I think there are some sort of ruling recently through the sex court on this particular issue that create also problems. And so we're proposing to repeal this particular provision and work with public finance and the Department of Women's Sector and grant to have more effective grant start-off with rather than trying to provide some additional relief to that system, which is very effective, really, and more complex itself. And we did meet with housing, and we explained to them this, and the effective date will only be 1st April 2017 to allow them to adjust their budget accordingly. Then the next one,
this one's really a complicated one, because many of these construction companies do both RDP housing and other projects and so on, and so it's an admin nightmare, and I was very, very glad to be involved in that administration of some distant past. But when you say that's their budget, so they're going to get a top-up on their grant to cover the additional debt.
Well, that is ideally what they should do, but obviously they're not going to get a top-up for their total budget. They need to be very specific which type of grants were intended to fall in this particular area and then budget accordingly. The problem that we sit on the other side is it's very hard to determine after the fact which grants were supposed to have done it. So, yes, we asked our public finance group and the Department of Human Settlement to relook at their budget and have a top-up. And that's basically why we postponed it until the 1st of April 2017, because they can't do it this for 2016. It's too short a period. Okay. The next one is, this is a threshold issue that should have gone into the threshold principle, what is happening currently is that if you're a commercial accommodation, and this is sort of largely the bed and breakfast stuff, there is a particular dispensation how the system works, to simplify the way you deal with that system. You had to have a threshold of 60,000. It was last adjusted in 23. We're now adjusting it to 120. It's just a system that's already there, it's a monetary threshold. Then the next slide deals with foreign companies sending their people to South Africa for one or other vocational training, and how we need to see that from a VAT perspective. So when you export goods or services, those services should be zeroed for VAT. That's how the VAT system works. That is a domestic consumption-based tax. The interpretation here, technically, if you come here for vocational training, you're not consuming it here. You sort of get the training and go consume it raw. And so there, the zeroing principle should also apply. Now, some people say you stretch the principle a little bit, but I think that's the spirit behind this particular provision. And so there is a particular provision that allows for it, but when there's sort of third-party involvement where the training takes place, the zero rating provision doesn't take place, and we only extend them to that particular provision. So it's proposed that the section be amended to ensure vocational training is zero rated. It includes instances where training is provided with third-party vendors for the benefit of employer who's not based in South Africa. Currently, it must be the direct relationship. This is just a third party creation. I think one example where this was initiated is was quite a few foreign pilots were trained in South Africa. And this is where the issue came up a few years ago, and so we provided for that, and I think it now goes beyond that. I'm not too sure how many people made use of it in one area, but it was one area which I know where people have come to South Africa. And that's it, Chet. This is mice, I think so. I'm not too sure, Franz, you've got anything specifically on the Evans side that you need to discuss.
Thanks, Chet. The slides I've given here are pretty much the same slides you've seen already, given that it was a very short period that we ran through that, so there may be questions people may wish to ask on them, so they are available to look at. What I would propose to do is just to look at two ones which I think will be of important and interest to the members, the one being the medical scheme fees or pay as you earn, because this has an impact on a number of individuals who are probably in your constituency and would like to know what's happening. So I've got a set of worked examples here just to show you how the system works. So we've taken someone who's 66. She earns 30,000 Rand a month this year, and she's paying 3,300 Rand a month for medical coverage for herself and her spouse. So we'll just quickly run through the calculation. You'll see that there's the 30,000 that's being paid. There's the medical scheme fee. And the important bit is on the next line. You'll see the pay as you earn is worked out on the 50,000 rands, right? That's the new system because there is no deduction for medical scheme fees. But what you will see is we give a medical scheme fees tax credit of 540 rand. It's 270 rand for the primary member and 270 rand for the first dependent. So the net monthly take-home pay is 21,154 rand. Fines are far. But because the person is over 65 or over, they actually get an additional deduction in respect of their medical scheme that works on the way that's sketched here. So they've got a 3,300 Rand fee that they're paying. You then reduce that by three times the 540 that they've been given credit for, so that's 1,620. So they have now what is known as the eligible medical expense that can go in for an additional credit. And this additional credit is 559 Rand, being 33.3% of the 1,680. But you'll notice that that's a separate tax calculation from the monthly calculation that the employer looked at, which means they're only going to get the refund of 6,708 Rand after they've been assessed. Okay, well, you could say, well, what's wrong with that? But that's not how it used to work. Before we changed the medical credit system for 65s and older, they got a deduction. And you'll see there, and I'm just using the same rates for purposes of illustration, on that model, their take-home pay was quite a bit higher, 22,541 Rand, as opposed to the 21,954 Rand now. In other words, they pretty much got a monthly calculation of the additional deduction they got. So what the proposal does is it simply says, let's go back to that system, and you'll see that the additional medical expense tax credit is now something that is taken into account when the employer works out the pay as you earn. So then the net monthly take-home pay goes up to 22,613, and that's in fact higher than they used to get. And why is that? That's because the medical tax credit system is in fact slightly advantageous for the system. That category of taxpayer. So there you go, that's the mechanics of it. And it should help people with some additional take-home payment every month, which is welcome, and also means you don't have to wait for refunds until after your assessment.
Just a point here, this is assuming the person actually still works. And so the way when a person has retired, it actually works slightly different, because there you do it to the provisional tax system. Maybe you should just explain that.
The provisional tax system, in fact, already allows you to take it into account. So we didn't need to change the provisional tax system. It was simply the pay-as-you-earn system that needed to be fixed.
Mr. Chairman,
through
the Department
this is to be implemented from 1st of March 2015, I assume. So is the industry, is our employers ready for this? I mean, are tax programs already been rewritten? They're going to now have to do some calculations, backdating it to the 1st of March, I assume, because they probably didn't implement immediately.
My recollection is from the 1st of March 2016 for precisely that reason. I know it's not a popular decision when you're talking to someone who's 65 years or older, but practically you raise the point. I mean, how would an employer be able to implement this at this point? They just can't. So there you have it. The other one was the extension of expiry period for additional assessment. Now, I made a point there that there are certain complex matters that drive one part of this proposal, which is the ability to extend for up to 3 years. Now, I've had the privilege of seeing some of the early comments. There's a trickle of them so far. The flood will come on the day that the comment period closes. And one of the points that's being made is that, well, why don't you simply work on the information you've got and leave it up to the taxpayer to provide otherwise or prove otherwise in court? Superficially an attractive proposition, and it works if you have a really simple case where the taxpayer is not being cooperative. But let me show you what happens in reality. This is the explanation of what happens. Let me show you the picture. Now, this is the picture we pieced together after 2 years of work. Right? When we first saw this deal, what we saw was a loan coming into NewCo to buy the business of OldCo, right, which was then transferred under tax-free rationalization. Remember, I did point out that placed issue on the system. And simultaneously, there was an investment by the groups in Vesco into a share, a package of shares, which gave it income. So there were two separate transactions. That's what we saw at the beginning of this. One, a loan in order to fund the purchase of the business, and then in another part of the group, investment. Well, that's fine, but it seemed a little odd, because normally if you have spare cash lying around, you would not use that as instead of incurring debt. I mean, if you have cash in the bank, you don't go and get a mortgage for your property. Because, in fact, generally speaking, unless the returns on whatever alternative investment you've got are really, really great, you do better to simply not incur the debt in the first place. And we looked at the returns, and they didn't really look that amazingly great when compared against the money that was flowing off. So then we started looking at the transaction. And what we discovered was that in the end of the day, what was actually happening was that this money was flowing in a circular fashion straight back again, and that the interest deductions that were happening in NewCo were coming back as tax dividends into InvestCo. Okay? So, wow. That puts a very different complexion on it, because, in fact, that's a loophole that we closed many years ago, because that's what people used to do. They used to take a tax-deductible expense offshore, then bring it straight to subsidy, then bring it straight back as a dividend, which you created an asymmetry in the system that can't permit it. So we closed that down. So how did we get around that problem here from a purely technical legal point of view? Well, on the left-hand side of that rather complicated slide, you'll see a group of bond sales. Now, the assertion that was made was that the money that was ultimately pushed out from InvestCo was invested in these bonds, which was true for approximately 3 hours. Then the whole thing collapsed and the bonds disappeared. In fact, since that was within the settlement period at the brokerage, we suspect those bonds never existed in the first place, because it was just a simple set of book entries, because you have a period to settle your transactions. That was not quite sufficient, though, so you'll see at the top of the slide there's a second set of self-cancelling bond agreements, which, sorry, I just need to do that, because this is one where I think you really do need to see the picture, which was again intended to break the linkage between the interest flow and the dividend flow that subsequently originated. So you may say, well, that's all very interesting, but so what? Well, the so what is that this was something where it really was pulling teeth to get all these bits and pieces out. Because as you can see, there are a number of different companies. And even where they shared directors and public officers, the group insisted, or the facilitator that was involved insisted on us leasing each one separately. We couldn't ask one question to one person. We had to sort of track it through. And any number of procedural points were raised that you are entitled to information along the way. It should then come as no surprise that when we finally unraveled this and disallowed and taxed, the very first point of objection was that we'd run out of time. Right? It took us 2 years to unravel this. And that was through some amazingly good work from our team in Johannesburg here in Cape Town. No, this is our large business center. Regrettably, anyway, I'm not going there. I'm going to say regrettably, one of the staff who was involved in this is no longer with us. They found somewhere better to be. Something of a loss. A challenge we face. So in any event, the simple point to be made and summarized here is, one last point, sorry, I almost forgot that. So one of the reasons that was advanced for this particular structure was bringing in the BE partners. You'll see them sitting there at 15%. Once we'd finished our analysis, we worked out that the value of the BE deal was less than 1/12 the value of the tax benefit. This was a case of the tail wagging quite a large dog. However, it does, of course, make it a little bit more difficult for us to challenge, because if we challenge it, you know, well, are we trying to undermine a legitimate BE transaction? In this case, we were able to show quite easily that this was a bolt-on. Now, that is the kind of structure that we need to deal with, and why, when you're dealing with a particularly complex matter, and this was a matter where GAR was one of our grounds, you need the opportunity to be able to extend, especially if the other side is not cooperating and trying to stall you wherever they can. And that is the simple point I wanted to make with it. I'm still astounded that we actually managed to unravel this. One last point. After we raised the assessment, we discovered that whilst we were in the process of unraveling, they in fact changed the scheme. This particular transaction was reconfigured to move into a different jurisdiction. Something that's not readily apparent from the slide, because I've changed everything into rands, because I've anonymized it, is there was another jurisdiction involved. They changed the jurisdiction that was involved in that, because we were cooperating very well with that particular jurisdiction, but they moved it somewhere else. That is the long and the short of it. And that's one of the reasons why we feel it is appropriate in targeted cases to have the ability to extend the time that we can look at a matter.
In this particular case, just because of the time reflection, did we not then... You said you raised the assessment. Did they win?
In this particular transaction, no. Here, the uncooperative attitude came back to bite them a little bit, because we were able to invoke the material non-disclosure aspects of which then displaces the 3 years. But it was certainly an arguable proposition from their point that they felt they had made proper disclosure. So it created one of the areas of uncertainty. I can say that this particular taxpayer at the end of the day did settle with us and has paid over a fairly substantial amount of money.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So in terms of the extended expiry period, what does the amendment say about the criteria and the authority to do it and so on?
All right, so just to move back here, there are three things that could trigger an extension. So you fail to provide the information within a reasonable period. Now, of course, people ask, what's a reasonable period? To be honest, I think this is a taxpayer protection, because if we said within the period specified by SARS, you could come up with a situation where some SARS official gives you 15 days to respond, and in fact, you need 60. So reasonable periods is one point. The second is there's an information entitlement that takes time to resolve. So this is where they're claiming privilege. You have to go through a whole process to get the information. Perhaps privilege is correctly granted, in which case, well, we don't get it. Maybe it's incorrectly claimed, in which case, well, we've been delayed. And so what happens to that dead time? So that dead time then doesn't count against SARS. The question that I've seen raised in some of the comments is, well, what happens if SARS sits on the thing? Well, that's at our risk, because nothing has stops it when we're sitting on it. And then the final thing is a complex matter, and there we give an example of transfer pricing or potential application of the general anti-avoidance rule, because those are two very clearly complex issues. There are also a number of procedural safeguards built into the GAR legislation. We have to give taxpayers notice. Before we intend to apply it, they then have a period of time that they have to come back to us to tell us why that shouldn't happen. All that also eats into the time available. Of course, having said all of that, the potential may still be that, well, what stops the rogue auditor going out and misusing this provision? And we certainly appreciate the force of that argument. We don't think we have many rogue auditors, but potentially that could exist. And so here we've said the person who gets to make this decision is the commissioner. So this is something that is clearly meant to be targeted at the most significant cases. Having said it's reserved to the commissioner, bear in mind the commissioner is permitted to delegate, but that kind of delegation happens at a very, very high level, because the sort of intermediate level would be the senior SARS official, and that is specifically not what we've used here. We've used the commissioner. So this is a very targeted provision. It's, from a purely practical point of view, not something that is going to happen every day. I don't think very many of us here would be considered in the context a complex affair. This is something that you would typically encounter at our large business center. Uncooperative taxpayer, yes, that's something that you may encounter at any Scotland. But there the criteria are a bit more defined. So those were the two issues that I thought would be useful to discuss here. But there were a number of other tax administration proposals that were discussed at the briefing, and if there are any questions on any of them, I'd be happy to take them. But I'm not sure that we need to go through them again.
Well, then, if that's the case, I think for the 12:32, we are at our time. I claim that because so many members are not here. Last year, we couldn't finish the report, and we sat for a whole day. So based on that, we started at 9 and decided to sit until 2:30. But I think we've covered a lot of ground. The aim was just sort of get a feel for what the issues are, understand them a bit more. And if the public hearing, then we will engage much more vigorously. Okay. Yeah,
quite self-serving kind of a question, Mr. Chairman, and you've probably been involved in these discussions before. The question of members of parliament deductible expenses, is that something any of you deal with? I mean, it's been on the agenda for a long, well, since I arrived here in 2009, and doesn't seem to get anywhere.
This term. I don't know anything about it. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah,
maybe.
The interaction between SARS and the Parliament, I think the late
members, Kosana was chairing a session where we did provide a response to that committee. But we'll have to take it up again. I'm not sure what happened there. So I think maybe, Franz, if we can just re-look at that correspondence that we've done and maybe brief the committee on that correspondence.
Thanks, Chairman. It's perfect enough for now.
Saying that you know, we found it useful, but it does come back to the point that I think it's extremely challenging for us to exercise effective oversight. And we hope that beyond PO, we will also get support from the Content Advice Office, Content Advisor, and finally research. And Bridget does help us quite a lot, but obviously she's got various committees to set out to attend to. We've asked the PBO to wait for the public hearings and then make their contribution there. And also they will continue to advise the committee on the responses you give to the public hearing participants. Okay. All right. Having said that, next week, Tuesday, as explained yesterday, because of the decision to cancel all meetings for next week, because we're all meant to be out on the local government week at NCO tonight, other weekend to have local government week on another week. And we still don't know what's happening about the provincial week. I think it's 15th to the 18th September. They don't want any committees to meet. But. So we don't really know what's going on there. So we cancelled. We had SAA on Tuesday. So SAA on Wednesday next week, and we had SARS on Tuesday in the original draft program. As I understand, Cindy, both parties agreed, but. And then we're trying to negotiate for them to come up. But they've already got other commitments. But what we have got is next Wednesday is a retirement reform workshop. And I'm wondering, given what happened today, whether we really need to meet so early. But maybe we meet, we got from 9.30 to 4 or to 14.30. I don't know whether we need that time, but let's mull over that. Then on Tuesday, if we don't get SARS before us, they will come before us. 2 weeks later. The quarterly report for National Treasury, the reason it's not useful sending it to you at this stage, to explain to new members, we normally have our program for 6 months ahead. Then we make minor changes to be fair to the parliamentary liaison officers, very good. We've been remarkably consistent for us. Now, what happened here was, I think I explained to you guys, the law, Trinity Bill, was meant to be taken on the 14th of July. And they were absolutely certain they would do it. And then we set this whole month aside for that. Now, unfortunately, it hasn't come, and it's soon to come. So all these dates are tentative. You see, for example, they all do confirm. These people are, and I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to have the list I gave you last week. All of that has been slotted in. But now, you know, it depends on your carbon tax bill and your Twin Peaks. The other thing to let you know is that this term we're not ending in the middle of September. We're ending on the 27th. Middle of November. We're ending on the 27th of November. Right? As long as you know that. Unusual. I don't know why we're doing it so late. And the NDVPS is what is it? A lock-up session. It's Wednesday, the 21st of October. Sorry. You can speak. You know that you will never have been tonight, right?
We're still waiting confirmation from the Speaker's office, but that's the date that ministers requested for it to be tabled. But I don't have it formally in writing yet.
No, not on that one. I think can I just ask one question, sir? We would appreciate if you can give us an indication of when you're going to have the hearings on the TLEP, because as we would like to table the bill in Parliament by the MTVS date because of the process in terms of the signature and getting it signed. So,